With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public, free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom, and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Dr. Cliff Harvey is an author, clinician, researcher, and speaker. He's a leader in the field of carb-appropriate clinical and sports nutrition, mind-body health care, and the achievement of success in health and performance. And he's back with us on RCR for another Health Hacks. Good to see you, Cliff. Thanks for coming back on.
Thanks for having me back on, Paul.
You feeling healthy?
I am, actually. Despite having two young kids and not enough sleep, I'm feeling pretty damn good.
Oh, that's good to hear. Oh, that takes me back. Both of those things take me back. All right, so we've talked on and off with other people on Health Hacks about various diets, so on and so forth. And one that's come up before is keto, but I don't think we've gone into the piece parts of it. So that might be a good opportunity right now to do that. Are you up for that?
I am.
Okay, so keto is about what? Ketogenesis? Is that where that word comes from, or the keto part of it comes from?
Yeah, exactly. So it comes from, you know, the full name, I guess, is ketogenic diet. And as that denotes, it's a diet that elicits a state called ketosis in the body. And ketosis is basically when the body doesn't have enough carbohydrates to do what it usually does. So it starts to produce ketones, which are an alternative fuel that the brain and central nervous system can use. So it's really a survival state that the human body developed, so that if there was, you know, energy restriction, or if there weren't enough carbs around in the diet or in the environment, that the body would still get along pretty well and function pretty well.
Isn't it amazing? There's always like a redundant system available.
Yeah, that's right.
A system of redundancy in the body. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, humans are amazing omnivores. You know, we can get by on a whole bunch of different diets and adapt very well and, you know, get by healthily on a range of different foods.
I think there was a 60s group called the Ketones.
Probably was. I'm not sure they were in ketosis though, mate.
No, nothing to do with it. All right. So when would you go, or what circumstances would lead you to this kind of diet, either being recommended or you're taking it on?
I guess it's a good opportunity to sort of look at the history of the ketogenic diet. And, you know, like I said before, the state of ketosis is something that was very natural and very normal for the human body. So throughout history, we would have gone into and out of ketosis at times if there wasn't enough food around, if there weren't enough carbohydrates around. But it wasn't until, well, actually, in the fairly early days of medicine, we're going back to sort of the ancient Greeks here, they realized that people who had seizures would often not have those seizures if they were starving.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But you can't starve people forever just to avoid seizures, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it was much later that people realized that it wasn't the starvation per se, it was the starvation eliciting ketosis. And so people started using ketogenic diets, which were, you know, very restricted in carbohydrates, to help people with epilepsy. Slightly earlier than that, in the 19th century, people had started using ketogenic diets, or what we'd now call ketogenic diets, as a treatment for this burgeoning state of obesity that a lot of people were getting, because that was, yep, you know, fairly rare earlier because there wasn't enough food around. But as food became more abundant, things like, you know, the Letters on Corpulence by William Banting came out, and that recommended a very low carbohydrate diet. You saw that coming through in literature where, you know, even Tolstoy talked about avoiding sugars and starches to get your wind, you know, to be sort of leaner and fitter and healthier.
Right.
And then in more recent times, people have obviously used that mostly as a weight loss diet. It, you know, had its resurgence in the 70s, 80s, again in the 90s through Atkins. And more recently, it's become one of the most popular diets, particularly for weight loss. And if you go back to the early days of when I started looking into ketogenic diets, it was about 30 odd years ago now when I tried my first ketogenic diet and started working.
Yep.
Yeah, and started working with people and applying ketogenic diets in certain cases. And over that time, it's just grown in popularity to now where it's one of, you know, the most popular diets that people use for weight loss and to improve their health. And there are more extreme versions of it now, like carnivore.
Carnivore is all meat.
Carnivore is all meat or pretty damn close, yeah.
Yeah. And that's okay, is it?
I would say the jury's out. You know, what we certainly have is some very vocal advocates who seem to just be thriving on a carnivore diet. There are probably people who do really well on a carnivore diet, but I'd also say that on balance, it's probably unnecessary. And for most people, you know, there is benefit to having more plant foods in the diet. I'm not saying a plant-based diet, like a vegan diet. I'm saying, you know, having lots of vegetables along with your meat is probably the best option if we just go on the research.
I think I mentioned this before ages ago, but I'll mention it again because I get your reaction to it. When I was overseas once in South America not too long ago, went to a restaurant with a friend. It was one of these meat restaurants where they come around with all sorts of meats and they just keep feeding you meat, you know, for as long as you can take it. Yeah. I ate a lot. It was beautiful. And it was the most amazing I had ever felt in the 2 weeks after that in terms of health, vitality, energy, everything. And I thought, boy, it must have been that.
It may well have been. I mean, there are a lot of reasons for that. It could have been that you had just been under eating a fair amount. It could have been.
I don't know about that, but okay.
It might have been that it was providing, you know, a big boost of B12, iron, you know, all sorts of things. And I certainly don't think there's any good health reason to get rid of meat. That's for sure.
Yeah.
I think, you know, a balanced diet that includes meat is probably, dare I say, at the safest, because you're not having the same risks of having, say, iron deficiency or B12 deficiency. But again, you know, there's probably benefit as well in having lots of brightly colored foods, vegetables, berries, all those types of things. And they're not necessarily restricted on a ketogenic diet either.
Yeah. In terms of the information about these diets, and I wonder, does a keto diet put all the old calorie counting diets kind of out of business?
Well, people who are very zealous about a ketogenic diet would claim so, but not really. What we typically find is, interestingly, that when we look at different diets, so let's say we compare a ketogenic diet to a high-carb, low-fat diet, if the energy intake's the same, so in other words, if the calories are the same, over a fairly long period of time, we see pretty similar results.
Right.
For fat loss, for health outcomes. So it doesn't really seem to matter that much. There can be some clinical cases in which ketogenic diets are highly recommended. But at the end of the day, because over a longer period of time, we see a fairly small effect size between these different diets, it really comes down to what works best for people's behaviors and habits. And that's really what a ketogenic diet is helping a lot of people with. It's not that it's magical and you're suddenly going to lose a whole bunch of body fat without having to count calories. It's more so that you don't need to count calories as much as other diets, often because it's so satiating, right? So it helps you feel fuller for longer. It's usually ample in protein. And so people tend to auto-regulate their energy better. In other words, they eat a little bit less if they've tended towards overeating.
Yeah.
And so that's really the... If there is any magic in a ketogenic diet, that's what it is. It's nothing that's more complicated than that.
I suppose when things become popular, they can sort of be seen as like a fad. And then, you know, people leverage off that and look for opportunities off that. How trustworthy is the general information surrounding a diet like this out there? People go, look, you see online. You know, how do you filter information to kind of, you know, get some accurate information?
That's a really good question, Paul, because it's difficult. Because unfortunately with diets like keto, you tend to have a very polar ideas of it, right? It's a lot like politics. And so you have I know. We won't get into the other discussion you were having before.
No.
You tend to have the very orthodox position, which is that, you know, keto's bad, it's too high in saturated fat, it's going to lead to heart disease, you know, you shouldn't do it, you've got to eat lots of carbs. On the other hand, you'll have people who say, no, keto basically cures everything and you can eat as much as you want without any problems and you'll just lose a whole bunch of body fat. And neither of those positions is correct based on the evidence. And so really what we need to come back to is that First of all, ketogenic diets do have a place in clinical nutrition. They're a really good treatment for seizure disorders and epilepsy. They're a very good intervention, if the person's prepared to do it, for diabetes, metabolic syndrome. There's evidence maybe for some other conditions. There's emerging evidence for neurodegenerative disorders. There's maybe some evidence for certain mental health challenges. And so there's quite a lot of accumulating evidence that for certain conditions, it's great. On the other hand, it's also a potential way of eating for people who just gravitate towards it. You know, they like the diet, it helps them to eat an appropriate energy balance, and so it works really well in that respect. Now, the biggest thing to remember is that, again, neither of those polar ideas of ketogenic diets are necessarily correct. Where we can come to in the middle is that if a diet, including a keto diet, is covering the nutrient bases of essential vitamins, essential minerals, getting enough essential fats, getting enough protein, and it's energy appropriate, hey, at the end of the day, it's probably not going to be much different to any other diet in terms of longer term health outcomes.
Yeah, you mentioned, you know, things like heart disease. Well, I think you touched on that just before, but there are others, diabetes, cancer. And it was my impression up till recently that if I, and I had a heart issue over a year ago now, come out of that fine, so that's good. But I was told at the time that that was probably diet related, because I hadn't injected myself with anything. Unlike the what it is now, diet-related, and that was, you know, too much meat, too much butter, all those things. And, of course, I assumed that, yeah, of course, that makes sense. But now I know more, and it probably wasn't those specific things. It was more, you know, highly modified foods and the wrong sort of cooking oils and things like that. Anyway, so for people who want to eat this food, how risky is it? Or is that now changing? Is that, has science changed that view now?
I think the science should have changed that view, but the view's still out there. And the view isn't without evidence. You know, there is an association between particularly increased saturated fat in the diet and LDL, which is that low-density lipoprotein cholesterol that people call bad cholesterol.
Yeah.
And there is an association between that and particularly heart events, not so much mortality, right? But those associations are also quite controversial.
When you say events, what do you mean? Like blocked arteries and things like that?
Yeah, heart attacks and angina and, you know, things where we can see a sort of functional outcome related to the health of the heart, but not necessarily death, and certainly not all-cause mortality, which is death from, you know, any cause. And so that makes it a little bit washy anyway, and not every study shows that. The associations aren't clear. You know, I just published a reanalysis of one of our studies from 2019, because for some reason I hadn't thought to do it before. We'd done a lot of analysis on the study, but one thing we looked at, or one thing that I looked at in the reanalysis, was there was going to be an increase in saturated fat because it was a study looking at three types of low-carb diet. So you're going to figure there's going to be an increase in saturated fat, and there was in all groups. But there was no association between that increase in saturated fat and increased LDL. It just didn't really play a role.
Okay.
And here's where there's a bit of, I think, incongruity, is that a lot of people who are far more orthodox in nutrition will say, oh, well, you know, sugar doesn't really matter in the diet, so long as you're getting all the nutrients you need and you're diet's energy appropriate, don't worry too much about the sugar. But then they'll say, but drastically limit saturated fat. And I'm sort of there saying, well, I kind of agree with you just to a point on the first, but on the second, surely it's the same. You know, in the context of an otherwise healthy diet, is saturated fat really a risk factor? I'd say it's not, because heart disease is way more complex than just one nutrient, one marker. In the same way that cancer is really complex. And so that suffers from a lot of oversimplification as well. You know, particularly at the moment where a lot of people are saying keto's a cure for cancer, that's, you know, a pretty sort of risky proposition as well.
I've got a question about cancer, because it's been coming up in things I've been seeing lately. And I've had cancer before too. So, I'm always interested in it. And that is talk of it actually being a parasite. Have you read anything about that? So not a genetic sort of out of control genetic problem with cells that have lost their marbles and, you know, are grotesque and growing out of control. But cells that have been sort of infected with some kind of parasite, and it seems that ivermectin can be quite useful. Now, that might be loose talk, but it seems to be talked about more now.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure about the parasites per se. I do remember reading something about that, and there can be, you know, particularly in this sort of modern, or this current environment we have, I should say, there can be a lot of jumping the shark, you know. But I think what we do know is that, yeah, it is really complex, and there are pathogens and parasites who are definitely associated with cancer, right? So we already know, for example, that oncoviruses are a trigger for cancer. So they're cancer-causing viruses.
Well, mine was HPV in the throat.
Gotcha,
and,
right.
And that has a viral origin, I was told.
Yeah. And so what we're looking at with cancer is several sort of genetic mutations that need to occur, and some of them might be triggered by parasites or, you know, other pathogens like viruses, but there's usually other things going on as well. So it's usually a combination of some of those things plus diet, environment, all sorts of stuff going on. You know, you've got to have the genetic proclivity somewhere as well behind that. You know, we all know the person who lived till they were 100 smoking, and the other one who, developed lung cancer. Yeah, exactly. And they probably just didn't have that genetic proclivity. We're exposed to that environmental toxin. It would usually trigger cancer, but it didn't in that case.
Back to cholesterol. It seems to be like any cholesterol is bad. That's where the statins come in, right? And I've talked to Asim Malhotra and other people who are very hot about that, go nowhere near it. How? I guess I'm mentioning that because how do you know that you're just not being sucked into the medical pharma industrial complex? Statins are one of the most prescribed drugs out there. When the cholesterol they're measuring could be really have no factor at all, you know, from saturated fats I'm talking about.
Yeah. So it's a really good point because, you know, there have been calls from certain doctors to prescribe statins to everyone over 40. And I just think that sort of mass medication is absolutely nuts. You know, it takes away completely from the ideas of personalized medicine and from our first tenet in health practice, which is do no further harm, because you don't really know what harm you're doing if you're just mass medicating everyone, right?
Well, I think we've just been through that. Well, there was an attempt to mass medicate, and we've got fluoride in the water. That is mass medication, so we're living with that.
Exactly. And, you know, the fluoride thing is an interesting example because it probably has, based on the evidence, it probably has helped with caries, you know, particularly in poorer populations and whatnot. But is it really,
well, is it really a good idea?
Is it a good idea to have people ingesting fluoride throughout their lifespan? I don't necessarily think so because, you know, a lot of the value of fluoride is topical. So if people want to use fluoride, put it on their toothpaste, you know, put it on their teeth, that's fine. I'm personally not in line with mass medicating with fluoride either.
Yeah.
And with statins, you know, I think there is just an overabundance of caution. They're sort of, you know, you're seeing cholesterol readings that are pretty normal. And if you're seeing cholesterol readings that are pretty normal in a person who is otherwise healthy and is, you know, eating a healthy diet, there's no reason to put that person on statins, in my opinion. Now, the idea is that it doesn't really matter. We should have really low targets, but there are adverse effects from having cholesterol that's too low as well. And, you know, those are things like neurocognitive effects, neuroinflammation, you know, brain fog, muscle aches, lack of energy, loss of libido, those types of things.
Yeah.
And the reason that occurs, of course, is because cholesterol is essential within the body. It's like people forget about the function of things in the body. They just see them as a marker of poor health. But what is cholesterol? You know, cholesterol is the building block of all those lipid-based hormones. What is LDL that people call bad cholesterol? That's just the bus that takes cholesterol out to do its job.
Right.
So you've got to have the bus going out. You've got to have enough buses, HDL, taking it back for metabolism as well. If you've got all those things in balance, hey, it works pretty well. And so, you know, as clinical nutritionists, we will never look at one marker in isolation because it's just a snapshot that doesn't tell the whole picture. We've got to look at all the markers in complex and then look at the person overall as well and what that actually means for them, because everybody's that little bit different and we need to treat them so.
Are you finding that people are thinking for themselves a bit more? I mean, I just remember with the statin thing, I told the heart guy when I went to my appointment, he said, well, you're taking the statins? I said, no. And he nearly fell off his chair. I said, one of the most respected cardiologists in the world has advised me that it's really not necessary. And it kind of ended there. But I was surprised at the reaction. It was like horror that I could have done this.
Yeah.
And I guess I mentioned that because there's pressure to conform. I'm wondering if you're seeing in what you do that that people are more open to these sorts of diets, want to know more, and are trying to take a bit more, you know, control for themselves.
I think people definitely want to know more. People have access to so much information now. I think the real challenge is being able to sift through that information and have the critical awareness, maybe the skepticism, you know, of things coming out of very polar positions, and some degree of scientific literacy where they can actually understand that. There are obviously people who are very good educators and communicators about science.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, some of the biggest voices are either, you know, from way out of left field where it's got no basis in reality, or they're so orthodox, they're not really speaking to the evidence anymore. They're just speaking from position stand. And so I guess, you know, when we can find those people who have a pragmatic, evidence-based and open approach to science, those are the ones we need to, you know, keep listening to.
Yeah. Well, we try and talk to those people. You will be happy to know, and you're one of them, Dr. Cliff Harvey. So that's why you're here. If anybody wants to find out more from you, how can they do that? What's the best way?
Best way is to go to my institute. We train people in health coaching, sports nutrition, and clinical nutrition. That's the Holistic Performance Institute, and it's easy to find because it's just holisticperformance.institute.
Are you finding, here's an interesting question, people that you help, are they performing better than the baseline, let's say, of what athletes or sports people can you see?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like I said earlier, Paul, I've been working with, not exclusively, because, you know, obviously my approach is called carb appropriate. It's about finding the right diet for for the person. But I've been working with ketogenic and low carb diets for over a quarter of a century.
Right.
My clinical clients are often people who have been told, look, this is just the way it's going to be. You're stuck, you know, either with an autoimmune condition or maybe if it's a cholesterol or lipid issue, they're often just told, oh, well, look, you tried the dietary guidelines, you know, you tried the old food pyramid stuff, it didn't work. So it's obviously just genetic.
Yeah. Nothing we can do kind of thing. Yeah,
exactly. And then when they get on a plan that works for them, things improve, you know, and it's not just the clinical side of things. As you know, I've worked with Olympians, world champions, you know, Joe Parker, our latest world champion boxer again.
Wow. Okay.
Good on him, you know, and many, many athletes. So it's not just about those clinical cases. You know, we're seeing drastic improvements in performance from sometimes atypical approaches, because some of my athletes, for example, will be on very high carb diets because that's what suits them in their sport best. Others, very low carb and performing really well. So we need to get out of this mindset that there is, you know, any sort of perfect diet, because at the end of the day, it's what works for the individual. So long as certain boxes are ticked, you've got to cover your essential vitamins and minerals. You've got to have enough essential fats. You've got to have enough protein. Cover those things and get an appropriate energy balance. There's lots of different ways to skin a cat.
Dr. Cliff Harvey, nice to have you back, and we'll talk again. Thanks so much.
Great to be back, Paul. Thanks, mate.
If Reality Check Radio enriches your day in life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and the dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.